From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the partisan rhetoric in Washington is intensifying as new court filings suggest President Trump may have skirted campaign finance laws.
There's a very real prospect that he may be the first president in quite some time to face the real prospect of jail time.
If someone makes an error in filing paperwork or in not categorizing a campaign contribution correctly, it shouldn't be jail time. It ought to be a fine.
Also today, more evidence pointing to the health benefits of the Mediterranean diet. And whether you want to create the next jazz masterpiece or make it onto the New York Times bestsellers list, a Northeastern professor says he's found a formula for success. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. The partisan rhetoric in Washington is intensifying as new court filings suggest President Trump may have skirted campaign finance laws.
There's a very real prospect that he may be the first president in quite some time to face the real prospect of jail time.
If someone makes an error in filing paperwork or in not categorizing a campaign contribution correctly, it shouldn't be jail time. It ought to be a fine.
That's Congressman Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, and Republican Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky. Prosecutors are recommending prison time for two former members of President Trump's inner circle, and the president's current circle continues to break apart, with White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, a Brighton native, planning to leave at the end of the year. And joining me now to sort through the latest Washington turmoil is my friend and former colleague Aaron Blake. He's a senior political reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post. Aaron, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's great to be on with you, Callum.
So let's start with the search for a new chief of staff. Nick Ayers, who's the chief of staff for Vice President Pence, was being considered for this role, but he turned it down and, like Kelly, will be leaving the White House at the end of the year. So if Kelly represented discipline as a Marine general, what does Trump's interest in Ayers tell us about the kind of person he's looking for, even if the pick won't be Ayers himself?
Well, I think it's the next person in line. He was the most obvious selection for that job, given that he's somebody who the president's worked with. He is somebody who has worked well, actually, with the president's son and son-in-law and daughter, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, which is not something that we could say about John Kelly. That was the source of a lot of the tension within the White House, was that he never really navigated the complex dynamics that have to do with the president employing his son-in-law and his daughter as senior advisors within the White House. And Ayers is just somebody who is, you know, very well regarded and has been around the block, has ties to both the establishment, but has also been willing to work in the Trump White House, which is not something you can say for a lot of people within Washington right now. And so the question we confront now is, who next? And there aren't a whole lot of conventional choices in line, and that's why we're seeing a lot of unconventional names being floated at this point.
Yeah, for that job and for others, too, right? I mean, we've got other changes going on in the administration. We've got the president nominating William Barr to replace Jeff Sessions as attorney general and Heather Nauert to replace Nikki Haley as U.N. ambassador. And, Aaron, these would at least seem to be very different kinds of picks. Barr has been the attorney general before under Bush 41, so his relevant experience is obvious. But meanwhile, Nauert is a spokeswoman for the State Department, and before that was the fourth cast member on Fox and Friends. So is there any unifying theme here?
In a word, no. I would say that William Barr is probably one of the more traditional picks that the president has made for his cabinet. But what we're seeing with a lot of these other positions is that it is becoming more and more difficult for the president to find people to fit in. You might think back to a few months ago when the president picked his personal doctor, Ronnie Jackson, to be the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, somebody with very little leadership experience, at least as far as a complex federal bureaucracy who was put in the position of handling a very troubled institution within American government. Heather Nauert is very much an untraditional pick for the United Nations. I think it fits with Trump's attitude towards the UN in that he's more of a nationalist. He doesn't necessarily view these international alliances as being particularly worth his time or nominating somebody with lots of experience. But it's also a symptom, I think, of it's just going to get more and more difficult to find people to fill these jobs. A number of Trump cabinet secretaries have found themselves on the end of Trump missives once they leave, when they've been too honest about their experience there. A lot of them have found it just very difficult to work within him. Thinking, of course, about Gary Cohn as the National Council of Economic Advisors, Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State. A lot of these guys and women are confronting situations in which they may really like the idea of being a cabinet secretary, but they've also seen how it can really go sideways on somebody because of the kind of leader that the president is. And I think that's making it much more difficult to recruit for some of these jobs.
And Bill Barr did write that notable op-ed last year defending the president's firing of James Comey as FBI director. So maybe the common thread between him and Nauert is defending him in the media. And the president is on the defensive, Aaron. You know, on Friday, we saw some major court filings related to the Trump, to the former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, and the president's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. And Aaron, you broke down five big takeaways from those filings for the Post. Could you give us one for each of them, maybe one for Manafort and one for Cohen?
Yeah, so I think the big finding with Cohen is that Robert Mueller, for whatever reason, seems very focused upon President Trump's efforts to build a Trump Tower Moscow. This was, of course, a focus of the plea for lying that Michael Cohen gave a couple weeks ago, but there was always a question of exactly why Mueller was focusing on this particular lie when it's clear that Michael Cohen has told lots and lots of lies over the course of his talks with investigators. The most likely answer was that this was an event that was interesting for Robert Mueller for one reason or another, and I think that the documents this Friday reinforce that and suggest that Mueller sees this as an area of inquiry when it comes to potential collusion. In fact, if you look at the documents, there is an extensive rationale provided for exactly why this is an area of interest for him, which I thought was a very pregnant inclusion. As far as Paul Manafort goes, the interesting thing to me is that two of the five areas in which Robert Mueller's team says that he has been untruthful with them after striking his cooperation agreement have to do with a Ukrainian business associate named Konstantin Kalimnik, who the U.S. government has said, as of a few months ago, had ties to Russian intelligence as of 2016. That was, of course, a very conspicuous inclusion in that filing. So this suggests that there was lots of questioning about Kalimnik when Paul Manafort decided to cooperate, and it also suggested that Paul Manafort, for whatever reason, decided to lie about Konstantin Kalimnik. And I think the real question there is why he decided to lie about that particular set of circumstances, especially with somebody who is not going to see the inside of an American courtroom anytime soon and wouldn't seem to be in any legal jeopardy himself. So those are maybe the two most interesting takeaways that I had on Friday.
Interesting. And maybe we'll learn more in future filings. I'd like to bring in another person to the conversation here. Former federal judge Nancy Gertner is a regular on the show and a WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So, you know, in the filings on Friday, we had some stuff, particularly with Michael Cohen, related to, you know, campaign year payments to the porn star Stormy Daniels. And, you know, they would seem to be getting kind of far afield, perhaps, from the original mandate of the special counsel to probe Russian interference in the election and possible coordination with the Trump campaign. So what did you see in Friday's filings that maybe get to that core mandate that Mueller had?
Well, I mean, I think that what happens in any investigation, and particularly this one, is that he begins to follow the money that led to Manafort, on the one hand, Manafort's activities in the Ukraine and offshore accounts, and it, to some degree, it led to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, which is to say, following what happened to monies, Trump monies during the campaign. It also is, a classic prosecutorial technique. If you're investigating X and you come up with proof of Y, you don't say, whoops, that's not within my mandate. In this case, he basically passed that on to those who would be involved. So and it worked, right? I mean, Cohen understood the jeopardy that he was in and began to cooperate, not well, but cooperate.
So we have sentencings coming up here, Judge Gertner. We've got Michael Cohen this week on Wednesday, Manafort not until February, but what do you expect from those two?
Well, you know, one way to look at it is almost as if you look at this in terms of vectors. So Cohen's brief by his lawyers was suggesting no time and talked about his cooperation. And in a certain sense, they walked the plank because having said no time, it's very hard for them then to participate in a conversation about how much time. The government's brief, from the Southern District of New York, was really quite strong and angry about how Cohen had actually not meaningfully cooperated, that he had lied, and only when confronted with the facts that showed that he had lied did he begin to turn around, that he had not, done the kind of full debriefing that the Southern District expected. So they wanted something like 4 years, which is a minor reduction from the guideline sentence. The Mueller was interesting. Mueller couldn't say, oh, we want 2 years. They're part of the same government. So all Mueller said is essentially he did, that Cohen was enormously helpful in talking about the lie to Congress, in talking about Russian contacts. And so he said as much as he could without coming up with a number, which would put one part of the government at war with the other part. What will happen, it seems to me, is that there will be an upward pressure to 4 years from the Southern District briefing, and there'll be a downward pressure from the special counsel's briefing. And the judge could well do something like 2 years, but that Cohen will get time, I think, is extremely likely. Let me say one other thing. Even if he gets sentenced to imprisonment now, if he cooperates over the course of the next year, the government can always file a motion asking the judge for a further reduction on the basis of his cooperation. So it's not over.
Judge Gertner, if Manafort and Cohen haven't been truthful with the special counsel's office, can we infer anything about the veracity of statements that the president might have made to the special counsel?
Well, that's the interesting. It's like unraveling a skein here. I mean, it goes in two directions. On the one hand, we know that Manafort was talking to the White House. We also know that Cohen was talking to the White House. And so the question is whether or not the president, in drafting the statement that he did, or having his counsel draft it, were relying on Manafort and Cohen's account. Because if he were, he may well have stepped into a false statement, relying on, expecting that this is what the special counsel knows, and therefore I'll do the same thing. In addition, in the Cohen submissions, there was discussion of who helped Cohen prepare what Cohen said before Congress. And that's a very interesting and troubling skein, because it could lead to lawyers in the White House as well as Trump himself.
So, Aaron Blake, in the moments that we have left, we heard Adam Schiff at the top talking about impeachment, and we've just heard Judge Gertner laying out some indications that could maybe point to obstruction or perhaps a charge of making false statements. But if there isn't sort of an underlying collusion crime here, will there be the political will with a divided Congress to actually move ahead with impeachment as a realistic possibility, Aaron?
Yeah, I think it's going to be difficult no matter which the more severe verdict from Robert Mueller's team it is here, whether it's on the obstruction side or whether it's on the collusion side. But I think maybe an interesting kind of option C here right now, and one that we're confronting based upon Friday's documents, is the idea that if the president loses re-election in 2020 and he's out of office come January of 2021, does the Southern District of New York potentially bring charges against him for this campaign finance violation that has been proven based upon the Cohen plea deal? And as of Friday, the government now says, in its own words, is something that the president himself directed and told Cohen to do. The fact that they included that language in these documents Friday, I think, was a very conspicuous inclusion. Generally, that's what you do when you're about to charge somebody or thinking about it. Of course, they're not going to charge a sitting president because that's generally not how things are done. But this is a man who could be out of office within 2 years, and the statute of limitations would not have run out by then. So that's a compelling third option here that I think we all should be aware of.
There's a lot still left to play out.
The false statements here are false statements about Russia. And in the Cohen filing, the special counsel was very clear to talk about contacts with Russia that were going on exactly at the same time as the hacking. So I don't think we've seen the end of that.
That is former federal judge Nancy Gertner, WBUR legal analyst, and Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Callum.
Stay with us.
Thanks.
There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. If you're 50 years old or older, you might be among the many people told by doctors to get the new shingles vaccine. It's two shots, taken within a six-month period. But many people are having trouble finding Shingrix. Pharmacies in Boston and beyond are struggling to keep it in stock. WBUR's Miriam Wasser brings us this report.
Shingles is the viral infection no one wants to get. It's a flare-up of the chickenpox virus that's been laying latent in most of our bodies since childhood. It can cause blistering rashes, severe pain, and possibly nerve damage or blindness. Without the vaccine, one in three Americans gets shingles at some point in their life. The older and sicker you are, the more likely you are to get it. So when Judy Stroll's doctor told her to get the new Shingrix vaccine, she went to her local CVS in Newton, expecting a quick in-and-out procedure, like for a flu shot.
First time I went, and they said, we don't have any. Second time, they said, we don't have any. And then I started calling. But then the word was out. There's no Shingrix. We tried Walgreens. We tried every pharmacy. They're out. I didn't know anyone who got it.
Having watched her aunt almost go blind from shingles, Stroll was determined to get Shingrix. It took her 5 weeks to find a pharmacy with the vaccine in stock.
When they developed this vaccine and then produced it, had no idea that the public would be so anxious to have this.
That's Dr. Richard Dupuy, chief of geriatrics at Tufts Medical Center. He attributes the spike in demand to three things: how well the drug works, advertising, and age.
It's now approved for age 50 and up, whereas the original vaccine was for 60 and up.
The vaccine is made by GlaxoSmithKline. In an emailed statement, a spokesman for the company also says unprecedented demand is causing the shortage. One person worried about the situation is Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone. The 52-year-old was hospitalized with shingles over Thanksgiving.
Anyone I've come in contact, they're probably sick of hearing, I'm saying, I don't care how old you are, go get the vaccine. And I've had several people who've gone and tried to do it, and he told me that they were told, it's not available yet, come back in January. There's not, we don't have it.
Okay, so you haven't found it. How much do you really need to worry? Well, if you're young and healthy, your chances of getting shingles are pretty low. About 1 million Americans get sick from it each year. Here's Dr. Richard Dupuy from Tufts Medical.
I think one way to look at it is this. Are we seeing more shingles today than we saw 10 years ago? I don't think so. And so if that's the case, then I don't think we should be panicking about this.
Dupuy says more of the drug is already on the way to the market.
The smartest thing to do is just get yourself on the waiting list. This is not going to last forever. And in several more months, there'll be plenty available.
Shingrix takes about 6 to 9 months to make, and GlaxoSmithKline has been ramping up production since May. Still, the company's not giving a timeline for when supply will meet demand, though the CDC predicts the shortage will continue throughout 2019. Doctors say that if you can't find Shingrix, it might be worth getting the older shingles vaccine, Zostavax. It's less effective, but still offers some protection.
That was WBUR's Miriam Wasser. And with us to talk a little bit more about the shingles vaccine shortage is Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thank you, Cal.
So you put up this digital version of the piece by Miriam Wasser on Friday. And what kind of response have you seen since then?
Well, it's been a surprisingly mixed response. A lot of people having trouble finding Shingrix, and a lot of people surprised that other people are having trouble finding it. And quite a few people like Mayor Curtatone who've had shingles, and they say quite emphatically, get the vaccine.
So are there any additional tips then on how to cope if you are one of those people who is having a hard time finding it?
Well, I think the main advice remains, as you heard Dr. Dupuy say, don't panic. Of course, if your doctor recommends the vaccine, which is happening a lot, you would like to cross it off your to-do list right away. But it's not like a flu vaccine. It's not like shingles is going around and you're likely to catch it soon. And you can try to be smart about navigating the system. Here's a bit more from Judy Stroll, who was featured in the story.
The reason I ended up finding it was that I have a good friend who decided that the way to research this was to find an area where there were young kids, mostly students. So she called around using those demographics and actually found it at a Walgreens in Austin.
Kind of brilliant, right? If you're young, you don't need the vaccine. But so as Judy Strell showed, you can get vaccinated with a little help from your friends.
Yeah, and those college students who were closer to the chickenpox age than the shingles age,
right?
So if the shingles vaccine is one of your get healthy strategies, you might have to wait until 2019 to get it from the sound
likely
of it. So
yeah,
put it on your New Year's resolutions.
Right.
And while we're on the subject and while you're here, Carrie, it is that season when we're thinking a lot about how to improve our health for the next year. One of the popular goals, of course, is always to get healthier, to lose weight. So what else should we be thinking about?
Well, if your resolution is going to be to eat better, which for many of us it should be, one thing I would note is that, you know, the more we understand about why we need to do something, the likelier we are to do it. And so there's some really interesting research just out about the Mediterranean diet.
And just to jog folks' memories, that's eating more like the Greeks and Italians and other Mediterranean cultures. So we're talking about lots of fruits and vegetables, olive oil, legumes, nuts, fish, whole grains, go light on the meat and those simple sugars, Carrie.
Exactly. And we should point out that, you know, it is tough to test diets, so you want to take any research with a bit of grain of salt.
But not too much salt.
Not too much salt. In fact, very little salt. And there is quite a bit of data suggesting that the Mediterranean diet really is good for your health. In particular, there have been major studies that came out in France and Spain showing that it correlates particularly with healthier hearts. So now we've got a really major long-term study in Americans, in American women, actually, about 26,000 of us. And here's the study's senior author, Dr. Samia Mora, who is a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Well, we found that women who were more closely following a Mediterranean-type dietary pattern were indeed at reduced risk for cardiovascular events over a long period of time, about 12 years. They had about 25% reduction in heart attack and stroke and vascular death.
So 25%. I actually would have thought it would be more, Cal, but Dr. Mora points out that that's about the same degree of benefit for prevention that we see with the statin drugs that are now so widely prescribed. And it's even more than we see for aspirin.
And those drugs, of course, are rigorously studied before they even get FDA approval. So we have some understanding of how they work.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the mechanism with the Mediterranean diet? How does that work?
So that was the question for this new research. And it involved measuring a bunch of different biological effects of the diet in our bodies. And the bottom line isn't really a simple bottom line. Like the diet involves a variety of foods, and it seems like it has a variety of effects on us. There was clearly a large effect on inflammation. And as you probably know, if you have more inflammation at work in your body, that raises your risk of heart attack and stroke. So that's one pathway. But Dr. Mora says there were several more.
We also found that improvements in insulin resistance and the way our body metabolizes the glucose, the sugars that we eat, that was really improved as well. And even the weight, you know, people think, oh, if I follow a Mediterranean diet, will my weight increase? In fact, the body mass index was lower, and that's actually what's also been found in some other studies.
And they found that the Mediterranean diet also tended to lower blood pressure. It was good for cholesterol. So there's this whole bouquet of benefits. And Dr. Mora points out that previous research has shown that even if you don't go whole hog Mediterranean, so to speak, like even if you just shift your diet somewhat toward a more Mediterranean style, you can still see some level of these benefits.
But so we don't. Do we know which elements are the most important? Because, you know, some, as you know, some other physicians have been critical of this study. And of course, as you said earlier, you know, it's hard to know exactly which factors are contributing most to the health benefits. So can we isolate, hey, if you can only do a couple of things, here's what to really target?
So we cannot, in fact. And basically, at this point, the takeaway from this study is kind of, it's all good. The fruits and vegetables and nuts and legumes, and my personal favorite, the extra virgin olive oil. Mm. You know, we can feel some leeway to focus on the elements that work best for us, because we really don't know which are the most important elements, Dr. Mora says.
I think my favorite would be the nuts. I bring the cashews or almonds to work every day, Carrie, roasted and unsalted. So
I'm paying
attention.
You are. So go with that. Go with the nuts. And, you know, also, even with all these effects targets that have already been figured out, there's still a whole lot more to be learned about what's going on with this diet biologically. The researchers couldn't measure everything, like, for example, what to look at to figure out how the diet helps prevent heart arrhythmias. And in fact, the paper on this study, it's out in the journal JAMA Network Open, ends with the note that even though we know a lot of the ways that the Mediterranean diet is healthy, so again, inflammation, glucose metabolism, weight, blood pressure, cholesterol, there's still a sizable proportion of how the diet reduces risk that, quote, remains unexplained.
Yeah, well, while we're figuring it out, I'll just eat more hummus and tomatoes for the holidays.
You do that. Hummus and tomatoes. And also the other main message is try to be in it for the long haul, Dr. Mora says.
I think the take-home point is that even small changes in these things, which may be not clinically even noticeable too much from day to day or from year to year, can have cumulatively, in a multifactorial fashion, they really contribute to the benefit and over long term, which is great. You know, so even if I don't lose weight today or tomorrow with, you know, having a more Mediterranean type diet, it is still benefiting me.
So she's kind of saying, keep the faith, keep the Mediterranean diet faith, even if you don't see results right away.
This isn't the lose 10 inches in 10 days type of thing.
Not that. Never that.
Oh, well. That's Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health. You can find a link to Common Health's report on this study on our website, radioboston.org. Carrie, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Callum.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Of the hundreds of thousands of new books that come out in the United States every year, only a few make it onto one of those coveted spots on the New York Times bestsellers list. So, our next guest asked, what sets those books apart? How exactly does a book become a bestseller? And he used big data to try to answer those questions. Albert Laszlo Barabasi directs the Center for Complex Network Research at Northeastern University, and he analyzed more than 4,000 book titles that achieved bestseller status in the past decade. Hello, Laszlo.
It's a pleasure to be here, Callum.
So you looked at the data, a lot of data, and you came up with a kind of formula for what really makes a bestseller. And it's not just about compelling prose and a good plot. What did you find?
Well, actually, there's lots of factors that play a role. And it really depends on whether you're thinking about fiction or nonfiction, because different parameters play a role. One of the most fascinating things that for me really mattered a lot is that track record matters in fiction.
Mm. And
the author's track record. And actually, the fiction list is packed with authors who have been very previously many times New York Times bestsellers, and it's very hard to make it as a newbie. In nonfiction, it's a whole different story. In nonfiction, it's very rare to have repeat bestsellers, and somehow it's always a fresh face coming up. And it may have to do with the fact that in fiction, you learn a style and you learn a way of kind of writing as a reader, and you know that in the next book you will get over and over. However, if I write a book about success, and previously I wrote about networks, my network audience may or may not actually transfer the success one. Or if you want to write about Mediterranean diet, as your previous show was about, and now I decide to write about American football, my readers will not come with me.
I see. So I think my takeaway is that it's good to be James Patterson. I think that's really the message, right?
He's a clockwork. He's totally amazing. Every 3 months a book and exactly the same number of readers from one book to the other one.
So if you are James Patterson, it probably doesn't matter what you write to some degree or when you put it out. People are going to buy it up because of that reputation. But for the first-time author, you've sort of devised almost a schedule on which it would be ideal to publish. What's the best time for a new author to try to break through?
Once again, it depends what's your goal, right? If your goal is to sell lots of copies and more people to read your book, then really sometimes October is the best release time because you're going to be ready for the Christmas when most of the books are purchased. However, it's a very tough time to get on the bestseller list because people are buying lots of books, so the threshold is very high. You need like 10,000 books to sell a week in order to get on the bestseller list.
Wow.
If your goal is to get on the bestseller list, forget October. Go for January to March, where there's hardly competition in that space, and with 3,000 copies a week, you can make the list.
So I know you have to sort of make this choice then, perhaps, between whether you want the bestseller status or you want to sell more copies. And you also broke down a possible choice authors might have to make between critical acclaim and making the bestsellers list, particularly in fiction, right? Those literary fiction novels that the critics love and the press eats up don't always sell very well.
They don't. And they really, even though most of the talk is about those books, really they represent a relatively small fraction of the books on the list. The vast majority are kind of thrillers and romance novels and kind of the trade fiction that really the people buy in bulk.
You looked particularly at hardcover copies, right? Do you imagine the trend would hold true if we looked at paperback and e-books?
We could have. We actually focused on the hardcover because that's when the book is first kind of introduced to the community. There are many examples of books that don't make it in the bestseller list and they make it in the hardcover, make it in the paperback. We have not focused in this study on that.
All right. So, Laszlo, you yourself have a new book out this year. It's called The Formula, The Universal Laws of Success. Did you follow your own advice? When did you publish?
Well, certainly. We published kind of early November, mainly because just to avoid the election season. And my goal personally was not to actually gain status of being a New York Times bestseller, but to actually get my ideas to as many people as possible. So we chose the fall time.
All right. So one of the industries that you tackle within the formula is the art world. And you come to what I think could either be an encouraging conclusion for people with little talent or a discouraging one for the truly talented. But either way, one of your conclusions was that talent isn't always a major factor in determining the success of artists. Explain that.
So one of the big questions that I'm struggling with in the formula is that what's the connection between performance and success? And if you're a runner, you are obviously, you know, your performance determines your success. But what's the difference between them? Performance is what you do, how fast you run, what you paint, what shows you put up in the radio. Success is about us. How do we relate? How do we acknowledge? And eventually, how you reward you for that performance? So your performance is about you, but your success is about us. It's a collective measure. So we learn in school that you have to have performance to succeed. And our research fully confirms that. The problem is that there are lots of people with high performance that are competing for success and not everyone gets it. So we try to understand the relationship between this. We look at sports, we look at academic research, we look at art. And art is particularly fascinating for us because performance is inherently impossible to measure.
It's subjective, right?
Is this microphone in front of me a working microphone or it's a work of art? Here, it's a microphone. If it's in MoMA, it's a work of art. Mm. So it really, what is art really depends on the context. You can't look at the object anymore and decide this is a valuable or not. It depends who did it, where it is, where was it before, and so on. So for us, art is fabulous because actually we can look at how success emerges without measurable performance. And of course, what we found in that case, that the key for success is the network. That is that we mapped out the network of how the artists move between institutions and galleries. And we find that the network that connected the institutions is hugely predictive of the artist's future. That if I know where an artist starts from, I can predict 20 years later what would be effectively sales price and what galleries will be willing to exhibit him.
Interesting. I want to touch on one other art form while I still have you, and this is a more musical form. Let me play just a little bit of Miles Davis' So What from his 1959 jazz album, Kind of Blue, and then I'll explain why we're here. So I wanted to play a little bit of Miles Davis, not only because it's a groovy tune, Laszlo, but because you used it as a good example of one of these universal laws of success you write about, which is, to quote you, while team success requires diversity and balance, a single individual will receive credit for the group's achievements. How does Kind of Blue exemplify that? I certainly just think of one person when I think of that album.
Sure. Let's step back and understand the fact that most of the creative work now happens in teams. That age where like a genius can come along and alone achieve and change the world is more or less gone, both in science and in art. And so the question is really, what is a good team, number one? And then once the teamwork has been achieved, and that's fabulous, who walks away with the credit? So Miles Davis is a beautiful example of what is a good functioning team. Because what the research shows is that depending whether the team wants to be creative or wants to perform a task that is well-defined, a very different organization works. Miles Davis is my example of a creative team where what we're learning is that for a successful team to emerge in the creative space, you need to have a strong leader and lots of supporting role. If, however, you need to have a high-performance team that to achieve a certain task that is well-defined, what is the opposite is true. You have to have a uniform team with highly diverse, where everybody's paying attention, no one is leading, and everyone is chipping in. So, of course, Miles Davis and Kind of Blue is fascinating because it's the most released album in the jazz history, and we know exactly what Miles Davis has done and how he actually exercised his leadership and what was the composition of a team that really resulted in this high success.
I see. So if you had a band of six Miles Davises, it might sound good in theory, but might not work out so well.
That would be a kiss of death.
Well put. And that is Albert Laszlo Barabasi, a professor at Northeastern University, where he directs the Center for Complex Network Research. And his book is The Formula, The Universal Laws of Success. Laszlo, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Callum.